Et ils traînent. Ils traînent leur...
Ipsilonia sur Radio Libertaire. Vous êtes à l'écoute d'Ipsilonia sur Radio Libertaire, la voix sans Dieu ni maître de la Fédération anarchiste.
I would like to think. Statement that the art to think of the art itself.
Vous êtes à l'écoute de Radio Libertaire 89.4. 89.4. C'était Ipsilonia.
You see.
Anything that the media has to say, which is sad because, you know, I feel cut off.
Je crois que je vais aller faire un tour.
Un petit tour.
Une révolution.
I would like to think that the art itself is enough of a statement.
Oh,
sai, Signore Dio. Caro padre assassinato, spinto alla mia vendetta dal cielo e dall'inferno, debba come una puttana scaricarsi il cuore a parole. E mi debba bestemmiare come una baldracca, come un sallone che vergogna, che schifo.
Ce soir, voilà deux parties. Nous avons des invités qui viennent d'Australie, mais bon, je vous laisse la surprise. C'est Kevin qui vous les présentera mieux que moi. En attendant, voilà, il se prépare là. Et en attendant, quelques dérives autour des années 2010, de quelques-unes des musiques qui m'ont captivé, frappé, intéressé. Donc, c'est un peu éclectique, mais voilà. Il y aura tous les détails des crédits sur le blog Epsilonia. C'est Radio Libertaire. Epsilonia, c'est Radio Libertaire. Je vous le signale. C'est pas rien. Alors, bonne dérive. Thank you.
Jordens rund, du högt förbi flygande ängel med brinnande händer. Under de många vintrar som följt på varandra
har våra ögon och läppar
allt mer frusit samman. Berör oss bara. En gång. Med dina glödande handflator.
Tryck dem bara helt lätt.
Mot våra nedisade ansikten. Och låt oss sedan sova. Sova lugnt i askan som blir kvar. Efteråt.
Hey! Bana üzgün, bana dargın. Bakma Allah aşkına, aman. Akla
Orange.
Yeah, hello, testing, testing.
Okay. Bleu.
Bonsoir, c'est Ypsilonia, vous êtes bien sur le 89.4 Radio Libertaire, la radio de la Fédération Anarchiste, sans Dieu, ni maître, ni publicité. Et ce soir, déjà, on va remercier Palix pour ce mix introductif. Voilà, la playlist, bien sûr, on la donnera sur le blog de l'émission, dont tout le monde se rappelle de l'adresse, forcément, epsilonia-radio.blogspot.com. Voilà, ça c'est pour les gens qui vont à la recherche d'infos, puis de l'info il y en aura, puisque dans l'heure et demie qui va suivre, en fait, on va avoir une émission un petit peu spéciale avec deux invités qui viennent de Melbourne, en Australie, le collectif Machine Listening, et donc d'ici quelques instants, on va passer en anglais, de manière à pouvoir converser avec nos invités. qui ont donc pour l'occasion, ils ont un programme très chargé à Paris, colloques, conférences, présentations. Et vendredi, on pourra les retrouver à la Générale à partir de 19h30 pour une séance d'écoute et une rencontre. On pourra un petit peu, on va dire, approfondir la discussion qui va commencer ici, puis qui est déjà en cours depuis quelques jours avec différentes rencontres à Paris. Donc Machine Listening, c'est un collectif qui a été créé en 2020 par des artistes-chercheurs. Cinder Cray, qui n'est pas avec nous, James Parker, qui est avec moi. Bonsoir James.
Bonsoir.
Et Joel Stern, qui est aussi ici dans les studios. Bonsoir Joel.
Bonsoir.
And now I'm gonna just switch a little bit in English. So I know this collective is was founded in 2020. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the let's say the artistic position of the collective, or the, because it's not only, you know, artistic, it has more implications. So maybe we can start by trying to define the area of action of the collective.
Sure, yeah. Well, hi everyone. Thanks for having us on the show. This is Joel speaking, by the way. So James and Sean and I have been working together since before we started Machine Listening. Actually, we came together a couple of years before that on a project called Eavesdropping. In that instance, James and I were the curators or instigators of a research project thinking about the laws and politics of listening. And that project was kind of came in the context of the Snowden revelations. It was very in some ways shaped by anxieties about surveillance and sort of the history of surveillance, but also the kind of the machinic and networked forms of surveillance that were being revealed. And we worked with Sean on that project in the context of him being an artist who was commissioned to make a work, and his work in this project, there's a wide range of projects that we did, you know, with artists like Lawrence Abu Hamdan and Susan Shupley, who you know, but Sean's work more than any of the other contributors really focused on the eavesdropping in the context of algorithmic culture, surveillance capitalism, sort of these new technologies of networked culture, what it means to live in a world of always on listening devices connected to one another, and that sort of hoover up sound as another form of data.
Yes. On your website, there was one sentence which says actually like all devices are listening to us. I mean, it's almost the first sentence we can read when we arrive on the website. It also sounds like a statement.
Yeah, James wrote that. I mean, you're very good at sort of snappy first sentences, aren't you?
I don't know what to say to that. I guess so. Thank you very much. At the time we were thinking about smart speakers, which had just been launched, and Sean's work involved, for example, a conversation between a number of different smart speakers, but they were kind of having a philosophical dialogue. It starts with smart speakers, and then it's your phones, and then it's your fridge and your kettle, and, you know, the work that we're going to present tonight is about the kind of the expansion of logics of machine listening outside of the home and into the environment, you know, the installation of networked microphones also in rainforests and in coral reefs. And so what we mean by a device that's listening to us is kind of constantly expanding. And this sort of the logic of the smart home is kind of being generalized and made ubiquitous. But you asked about what the machine listening is as a kind of a project. Joel's sort of described its genesis and how it felt like. It felt really timely. I remember at that exhibition feeling like machine listening felt sort of urgent, like the next thing that we needed to do. And there wasn't a huge amount of work on it. Machine listening is a term that comes from computer music. You might think of composers like George Lewis, but you know, they're not super widely known, and you know, outside of experimental circles. But beyond those circles, like machine listening isn't a language that the public uses. You know, they maybe know about computer vision and stuff, but the fact that our devices are listening not just to our speech but also to all sorts of different sounds that we make and aspects of the sonic environment wasn't, you know, it doesn't feel like it's as widely known as the kind of the computer vision, facial recognition kind of stuff. So it felt like a politically urgent project. And when we started it, we first conceived of machine listening as a kind of self-education, knowledge-sharing platform. We built our site with Pirate Care, which listeners may know. That's through Sean and his background in kind of radical education and knowledge sharing. And we sort of wanted to, the ethos of the project was to learn about machine listening together, but also to do it in public and to share resources. We used Library of the World, which I know you know, and platforms. I mean, maybe platform isn't quite the right word, because platform suggests so much the kind of the big tech version, but decentralized techniques for sharing knowledge. And so that was what machine listening was originally.
When we started it, we actually called it machine listening curriculum, and it was explicitly a pedagogical project, and we sort of understood it to comprise conversations, talks, shared resources, references, reading lists, etc. And the first events were these online events that kind of combined, you know, streaming of films and videos, audio pieces, interviews and discussions, online performances and things like that.
Yeah, because also I said it was, let's say, funded in 2020, but it's also the time of the COVID. So maybe it's also important to underline, just to give some context about the moment of the creation.
Yeah, we worked with Unsound Festival, experimental music festival, you may know, in Poland, and sort of did their discourse program that year in the first year of COVID. You may remember this was a time when everybody was suddenly very interested in like doing experimental things on Zoom. You know, we were all being forced onto Zoom for work and things. And like, well, what can we do that would work against the platform? And so, you know, we tried to do some interesting things. We had artists who were like Matin, for example, who was involved in one, who was sort of working with Zoom as an instrument. But we also we built a kind of a context where we were treating Zoom a bit like a radio station, basically.
We did three episodes initially as part of Unsound. The first one was called Against the Coming World of Listening Machines. And I remember that the people at Unsound said to us, critical theory, it's so dated. Why can't you be a little more positive about, listening machines and all the... So we just got the against and put it in brackets, you know, so that you could read it as the coming world of listening machines and you didn't have to be against. And the other programs, there were three programs. There's another one called How Not to Be Heard, or Lessons in How Not
to Be Heard. And How Not to Be
Lessons
Heard.
After
the Hito Stel
work. After the Hito Stel. And the third one was Listening with the Pandemic, which began with a piece by Sean that kind of focused on like these fantasies of, COVID detection through cough analysis, through machine listening applied to cough. So you can sort of see by those titles that is very situated in the pandemic, but it was also situated in this sense that machine listening is something that was happening very quick, that was accelerated by the logic of the pandemic. And that there was...
I mean, Zoom itself is a good example of that. It integrates machine listening in various ways in terms of the filtering and so on. And obviously, there was a lot of scares at the time around the transcription that was happening automatically and what was happening to those transcriptions and privacy questions. So Zoom itself as a medium was sort of bound up with the politics of machine listening.
We kind of forget, but the first couple of years of the project, we... conceived of it as a series of episodes, and each episode was a different kind of investigation into a different prism through which to think of machine listening. The one we did after was called Improvisation and Control. I might be getting the order wrong, but I think that's right, where we were trying to think about the relationship between the experimental music context of like these composers like George Lewis and others who were trying to improvise with computers in the 80s and so on, like trying to teach computers to respond to them as if they were, you know, another musician engaging in a duet. And then the way that we wanted to think about that improvisational training that the computers were having in the 80s as sort of a prelude to these new forms of capture and control that sort of appear in the 90s and 2000s, mm-hmm. often emerging out of the same spaces like the MIT Media Lab and the path from those academic research labs into companies like Google and so mm-hmm. forth.
Also, like the machine listening is a direct, let's say, like a relationship with the machine learning, which actually mm-hmm. like takes a lot of space in the public sphere. A lot of people are talking about AI, whether AI it doesn't really know it's a, let's say, like a word which, let's say, covers many different areas. So it's always difficult to know. Myself, I call it like laborious computing, but any people have different definition of it. Mm. But let's say like machine learning is also like a technique which is implied as soon as you gather some data. And you're here to present a record where actually which was also built with this kind of tools, like let's say speech recognition and voice cloning and let's say artificial neural networks, I guess, to process actually these voices that you use as to produce a record which is called Environnement 12, Environnement 12, I would say in French, and it's a record that comes to actually like conclude a series which was initiated in the 60s, end of the 60s, and which lasted a decade, 11 different records, and we will listen to them during the whole night. So I'm making some preparation, induction to the listener. The bande sans fin tonight is proposed with this series of records, but we will come back to them a bit later. And then this record, Environment 12, it's actually like this, let's say almost like a missing pieces, an update of this series with with this dystopic vision of the ecosystem, full of different sensors, a network of sensors, and it's almost like a piece of archaeology from the future that tells a little bit. So it's a bit dystopic, and I like the approach. And you use this voice cloning. Also, like to make it not like let's say it doesn't really feel like the other copies of the other reference of the series, but it's actually a new edition because there is no voices, no, in the original.
No, there's no voices. There's no voice, not intentionally. There is a myth that the maker of them encoded his own voice into
into the very first record.
Yes. But maybe it's worth just saying that. After that kind of initial phase of machine listening really being framed in terms of a kind of self and public education, we started to get some interest from people to, you know, make installations and make works. And this piece kind of came out of that process. It was commissioned by a gallery and originally made to be installed in Melbourne. And it came out of some research that we had been doing on the application of AI basically to bioacoustics, to the field of bioacoustics. So that's scientists who are studying not just animal sounds, but the sounds of the ecosystem, living things in rainforests, reefs, deserts, you know, all over the place. And some sort of quite strange things, in fact, that scientists have been doing in that field. You know, one example we came across pretty early was scientists who are recording the sounds of coral reefs in order to play those sounds back into the reef to sort of try and improve the health of the reef. And then this seemed to work, and so they thought to themselves, well, why not automate that process, because there's a lot of reefs, right? There's not enough scientists to do this work manually. So what if we can use AI? This particular project involved a collaboration with Google. There are many other examples, but we sort of stumbled across this field of research, and then we were trying to think about, we wanted to tell those stories. And then Maybe Joel, you want to say something about how that interface with the environment series, because you know, you don't have to tell the story of audio AI and bioacoustics by means of the medium of the environment series, but it sort of turns out to be quite an interesting mix.
Yeah, well, I mean, experimental and avant-garde music has always been a major reference for us. Like, it's kind of where I've come from in a really formative way, like through underground music scenes and noise music and, you know, composers. And, like, whilst the topic of the subject and the recurring themes of our work are, you know, around this phenomena of machine listening and the application of sort of AI to audio, a lot of the strategies and methodologies we use to produce our works come from experimental and avant-garde music, you know, like the compositional strategies and the arranging of the materials. And so in all of the works, there are these sort of references, but in this one, it's really explicit because, you know, we were sitting in the studio just thinking, how do we bring together these stories about, you know, like a kind of simulated environments and the reproduction of the soundscape? How do we bring it together formally? And the environments records, I had one. I've got a sort of... I keep most of my music records in the house, but in my studio I've got a box of records that are more like sound effects. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like non-music. And Environments was there. And when we had a look at that record more closely and considered it as a reference, a lot of things about the work kind of came into focus, like the idea that our work could be a record. It could be a concept album, you know, so like it didn't have to be a set of songs, but like a kind of an audio meditation arranged on two sides of a record. And at a certain point, the idea of Environments 12 came to us as a sort of a hypothetical 12th record in the series. There had been 11. They were made between 69 and 79. So it's like more than 40 years since the last one. And a lot's happened in those 40 years, obviously. But many of the things that happened since 1979, you know, with computation and AI, if you look at the environment series, there are these sort of, they're in a latent way, you know, in the techno-utopianism of the series, in the kind of willingness to embrace simulation as a strategy, and the idea that on the one hand, like nature has a kind of fidelity and authenticity and purity, but on the other hand, it's totally fine to kind of like digitize and add synthetic waves. And
maybe we should just say what the Environments series are. I mean, in just a very, very sort of simple way, every record in the Environment series has two sides. Each side is one piece of 30 minutes and presents a single soundscape. Mm. So the very first record, side one, is called Psychologically Ultimate Seashore, for example.
And what's side two? Is it English Meadow, maybe? Something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And
You're going to play some of them later too.
Yeah, tonight.
But it's worth understanding that, you know, these were... you know, obviously there had been nature recordings before, but these were marketed as something that you could take into your home to improve your well-being in some way. So the idea is that we've been alienated from nature. You know, we live in cities, car noise and factories and all this stuff. We don't spend enough time in nature.
Television and radio. He was very like, because you know, the guy who started the series, he'd studied with Stockhausen, right? And he found avant-garde music depressing. So in some ways, this was like an antidote to, you know, this idea of filling your environment with music.
And so he's really the first guy to say, you know, let's like instrumentalize, valorize nature sounds to increase productivity. To, you know, this is very familiar strategy now. Like it's like Spotify is full of, you know, the sound of rain as a kind of white noise that you can use to optimize your output in the workplace, right? And he kind of invents this.
And he also sort of invents or at least tries to popularize a kind of ambient listening, a kind of background listening where you don't pay attention in the same way that you do with a piece of music, but you try to forget that it's there, and you set the volume at a background sort like of liminal level.
Yeah, like music you don't listen to, but you hear.
Yeah,
that's right. And I mean, he literally gave instructions in the liner notes to the records telling you to engage with the music in this
way. But he was probably familiar with like Eric Satie furniture music and things like that. But it's couched in the language of kind of a sales pitch.
Yeah, it's marketing. Relations. And I think that's really important that like this was explicitly not experimental music. Mm. This was a product. It was extremely successful. It literally sold millions of copies. Mm. And so there's a kind of commodification of nature in a really overt way. It's not the only time it's not the first time that happens, but it's a pretty important example.
It's worth mentioning as well, like 1 year after the Environments record comes out, there's the record of Songs of the Humpback Whale. I don't know if you ever encountered that.
It's a classic too.
It's a classic as well. And that was also like, I think it was the first time that a non-human musical performer like appeared in the charts. You know, it was like the Humpback Whale was number whatever.
Yes, and there was something which is also like, I think, which also connect, because there was this, let's say, like proto-transhumanist imaginary, which comes like, you listen to the record, it makes you a bit like healthier, etc. Mm-hmm. It helps you to focus. But there was also this fact, the fact that the nature is not really, it's more than nature. It's like...
Right,
hypernatural.
So yeah, there is this artificial nature, actually.
That's right.
And maybe I think the good thing would be maybe to listen to this 11th, let's say, volume of the series, this new volume, anachronic volume, and then we come back with some questions and some okay, discussions. Cool. So it's a piece of 35 minutes on two sides. So we'll just at the end of the first side switch the to side B, and then so have a good listening and see you back in 35 minutes.
Is it difficult to reproduce the sounds of nature? I remember reading about a man on a beach. It was 1968. I remember he was an entrepreneur. And he was there with a composer to record the sounds of the ocean for a film. I remember he thought the recordings were beautiful. Too beautiful for the film. But they weren't perfect. I remember the entrepreneur took the recordings to a neuroscientist who specialized in the synthesis of speech. I remember they fed the recordings into a computer the size of a room. They wanted to process the ocean sounds the same way the scientist would process a sentence. Cutting, replicating, looping, smoothing. Adding synthetic waves till everything sounded just right. I remember the result was released in 1969. The psychologically ultimate seashore. It was side one of a record called Environments. I remember reading the liner notes. You don't listen to this record. You hear it, they said. I remember liking that. I remember putting the record on as I worked and my reading speed doubled. I remember the room seemed brighter. My apartment had never felt so pleasant before. I remember it cured my insomnia. Played it continually. I never got tired of it. I remember buying all 11 records in the Environment series. I remember They sold millions of copies. I remember thinking they were better than the real thing.
It was 1968.
It was 1968.
But they weren't perfect. But they weren't perfect.
Oh, I like to think of the sound of the seashore and the wind in the trees. I like to think of gentle rain in a pine forest just before a thunderstorm. I like to think of an English meadow, birds singing their chorus in the new dawn light. I like to think I can imagine what they're saying to each other, that nature is speaking to me through their song. I like to think of the dense and rhapsodic sounds of seals, whales and walruses at Osaka Aquarium from all around the Pacific Rim. I like to think of a loudspeaker attached to a van in Namibia playing the low frequency calls of a female elephant in heat. I like to think of a cybernetic biosphere filled with wildlife and electronics, biodegradable microphones attached to each and every tree. I like to think of smart cities, smart skies, smart rivers, smart oceans, seas, ice caps, forests, parks, and roads. I like to think of the scientists imagining their computers are listening, that nature is speaking to them through its song. I like to think of a listening without limits, the full planetization of audio AI. I like to think of the automatic assessment of plant stress based on ultrasonic emissions correlated with a variety of environmental factors. I like to think of biomimetic squirrel robots using acoustic and infrared cues to warn wild squirrels of threats and ward off rattlesnake predators. I like to think of scientists imagining that nature is listening, that their computers are speaking to nature through their song.
I once heard a story about a reef lullaby.
I once heard a story about a reef lullaby.
I heard that each night the reef sings into the sea, guiding its young back home.
I heard that each night the reef sings into the sea, guiding its young back home.
I remember thinking that was beautiful, this idea of a reef that could sing.
I remember thinking that was beautiful, this idea of a reef that could sing.
The oceans had been getting warmer.
The oceans had been getting warmer.
This is the song of a healthy reef.
This is the song of a healthy reef.
And this is the song of a reef that is dying, ravaged by overfishing and climate change.
And this is a song of a reef that is dying, ravaged by overfishing and climate change.
You did. But some scientists had an idea. They thought that if they played the song of a healthy reef back into a dying one, maybe it would help. Maybe the dying reef would start to heal. So they attached speakers to the bottom of boats over the Great Barrier Reef and played the healthy song for 40 days and 40 nights. And then the fish and coral came back. At least for a time. But there were so many dying reefs, each with its own song. And not enough scientists. So the scientists had another idea. What if they could train a computer to listen to the reefs and automatically compose a song perfectly suited for each one? A song that could respond to the seasons and the reef's changing needs. A song that would play forever, looping round and round. An artificial song that would sustain the reefs. But was also the only thing keeping them alive.
That is a beautiful memory.
Mm-hmm.
environments,
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 environments.
Reef lullaby,
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 reef lullaby.
I remember,
I remember,
I remember,
I remember.
I remember thinking,
I remember thinking,
I remember thinking,
I remember thinking.
I remember reading,
I remember reading,
I remember reading,
I remember reading,
I remember reading.
I remember liking,
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 I remember liking.
I like to think,
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 I like to think.
Better than the real thing,
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 better than the real thing.
Round and round,
round and round,
looping 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 round and round.
I once heard a story,
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 I once heard a story.
Imagine,
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 imagine.
This is the song,
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 this is the song.
This is the sound,
this is the sound,
this is the sound,
this is the sound.
Imagine an alarm system for nature, a system of speakers laced through the forest that could talk to animals and alert them to danger. Imagine a large language model, but for animal communication. If you can build a chatbot in French or Mandarin when you don't speak either, you can build one for animals too. You are going to need a lot of data. Luckily, as the Internet of Things matures, putting cheap and reliable microphones on trees and animals in the wild is easier than ever. Soon they will be
solar-powered and biodegradable.
The bioacoustic data can then be analyzed with AI and used by humans to recreate the sound of the animals to enable two-way communication. The key thing to remember is that machine learning can turn semantic relationships into geometric ones. A language can be represented as a shape. For instance, the word dog is close to words like friend and fur and how. Can we do generative vocalizations for animals? Not yet, but yes, I think in time we can. Can we do generative vocalizations for animals? Not yet, but yes, I think in time we can. Imagine an AI system that speaks whale or crow so fluently that the whales and crows can't tell whether they're speaking to one of their own. I think that's coming soon. Perhaps in the next 12 to 36 months. The plot twist is that we may be able to engage in conversation before we understand what we are saying.
I read about two Australian composers working out of a backyard studio in Prahran. I remember one of them had started a company that made soundscapes for institutions like museums, libraries, zoos, aquariums, galleries, all over the world. I remember hearing this was good business. I read about the sound design the two composers did for the gorilla enclosure at San Diego Zoo in 1991. And he paid that. The first of its kind, a huge undertaking. One of the composers had flown to Central Africa to record mountain gorillas. It was important, he said, to capture them as they actually sounded in the wild, without mediation, so that when they were played through the zoo enclosure, would sound just like the real thing. But I remember the other composer describing all the work he had to do to make the recording sound that way, to distribute them properly across 111 speakers, triggered by a stack of 19 CD players, half the size of a room, that he had to edit out the sounds of cameras from all the other tourists who had traveled to Africa to encounter gorillas in the wild. I remember wondering about this impulse to capture nature. And to turn what you've captured into memories, knowledge, profit, music. I remember reading that when scientists heard about the installation, they were excited. They'd wanted to study the effects of these sounds on the gorillas. They thought the sounds of nature might improve the gorillas' health and mood. But I remember the scientists were disappointed that the soundscape had no measurable effect on the gorillas at all. I remember reading that zoo-goers loved it, though, and the recordings are still playing there more than 30 years later, looping round and round.
Reefs, reefs.
Reefs,
reefs, reefs.
Reefs,
reefs.
Reefs. Reefs. Reefs.
Nature. real thing, real thing,
real thing,
real thing,
real thing,
real thing,
real thing,
real thing,
real feel thing,
real feel
thing,
real
heard a story in a rainforest full of microphones. There was a clearing beneath the canopy, and in the clearing were some speakers with a record looping round and round, playing a story about a planetary computer. I remember finding it beautiful, this idea of the world wrapped in a brain. Mammals and computers living together in mutually programming harmony, like pure water touching clear skies. The story imagined the world as a zoo. Every ocean an aquarium. Every forest a living room. The soundscape of the world perfectly calibrated and composed. And that's how it remained for a time. But I remember it began to rain. And as the temperatures rose, so did the humidity. The microphone started breaking. Water got in. Ants learned they could bite through the microphone's plastic seals and nest next to the warm batteries inside. Software failed, hardware failed, cellular and satellite connections failed, without needing a reason. Speaker cables were stolen by white-faced monkeys. I remember the story became increasingly hard to discern until it was gone, and all that could be heard was the rain in the canopy and chorusing tree frogs, the record silently looping round and round.
So yes, back, nous sommes de retour dans les studios de Radio Libertaire, donc la radio de la Fédération Anarchiste 89.4 à Paris, et puis bien sûr, on est aussi en stream, et puis sur le DAB+, et relayé par Pinode. J'imagine que certains auditeurs, auditrices de Pinode nous écoutent en ce moment même, et je suis dans les studios avec le collectif Machine Listening, avec qui on discute depuis tout à l'heure, en anglais. Puisqu'ils sont de Melbourne et on a la chance qu'ils soient de passage en fait en ce moment à Paris. Et c'est pour ça que je vais maintenant passer en anglais pour avoir un petit peu de correction vis-à-vis de mes invités. So just switching in English, and so we have listened to this record Environments 12, so the 12 opus of a series of 11. A bit anachronic, and one thing is on the original series, we said it before, there is no voices, there is no... And on this one, it's full of choirs, full of voices, full of stories too. And the voices are also processed with like a technique of voice cloning, but not only, there was also like a real voice actors. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination, if I understood well. And maybe we can firstly talk about like the narrative and what all these different choirs tells, not only, you know, the objective narrative, but also what does it tell, you know, all these different like synthetic voices and this mix, this combination.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the record now. It's open in front of me. I can see that there's 15 tracks, you know, 8 on side A and 7 on side B. It might not be clear when you're listening to it on the radio in one 35-minute sitting, you know, it sort of flows from one thing to the next, but the way that we conceived of it on the record, and if you ever buy the record or you even look at the notes online, you can see that there's 15 different scenes or pieces, and each one has a title and each one has a kind of story attached to it. It begins with the story of the first Environments record, Environments 1, and there's a voice telling that story of the Environments founder of Tybal standing on the beach and recording the sounds of the ocean. And that's, you know, that's the beginning of our record, and it's also the kind of establishing of the opening scene, if you like, of the framework for the album. But from there, it proceeds in a, I think, rather non-linear kind of way through a series of episodes. So some of them are more oral, like, you know, the presentation of soundscapes. Some of them are kind of poetic, abstract interventions in which voice clones kind of have these exclamations and utterances, and some are lullabies, more like songs. We thought of them as, you know, chants or mantras. And then others are narrative stories, and the stories are largely narrated by voice clones, as you said. I think we thought of the voice clones, these synthetic voices that were actually generated from the traces of the real voice actors that also appear on the record. But we thought about these voice clones primarily performing the role of storytellers, you know, and I think that's because the stories that are told on the record have a certain ambiguity or ambivalence about them. It's not clear from which time the story is being told, and it's also not clear how you're supposed to feel about that about that story. And, you know, whereas I think there's an entanglement of real voices and synthetic voices on the record. But one thing I would say for me is that the real voices have a kind of recognizable emotional landscape, you know, a sense of feeling, of authentic feelings being kind of articulated through the voice, whereas the voice clones have an affect that is very hard to read and very hard to...
But I wonder sometimes how legible the voice clones are as voice clones, you know. Maybe we know that they're clones. But I think when you first hear a clone speaking, you know, that very first story, I'm not so sure that you immediately register it as a clone. Mm. So one of the things is that it's the becoming, where as it becomes unstable and you start to question, wait, is this is this a real voice or a clone? Why is it? Why does it sound so strange? And I think it kind of, there are moments where there is a kind of undecidability, maybe, and that maybe the distinction between real and synthetic, or real and sort of enhanced or optimized, or, you know, might be a little unclear.
Mm. I mean, I'd be interested to know from you, Kevin, like, when you're listening to this record, because you said that it was on all day, in yes. And you had it playing. is it obvious to you when a voice is a synthetic AI generated voice, or if it's a real human?
No, I could say like from my perspective, yeah, you can really like navigate, you know, the uncanniness. So it's really unclear sometimes. Like I mean, like even if you listen for a few times, also because they mix together, or at some point, so you wonder. But for sure, there is moments of weird, you know, of weirdness, and there is also moments of more like nostalgic, and so it's very different as like you really navigate. But I think the whole color for me is this kind of nostalgic, which also appears, you know, from the list of titles. So I can just try to read them. Like, so Acoustic Enrichment, which is the title of the first song, Environments One, Psychologically Ultimate Session, and this is where you begin to enter, you know, the uncanniness. But they weren't perfect, and this is also the nostalgic effect, I like to think. And I think this is also a reference to Brodigan. Riff Megamix. Riff Lullaby. This is a beautiful memory. Dream Chord, Be In. Run and Run. Conversation We Can't Understand. Gorilla Tropics. Symphony Natura. Riff Lament. Planetary Computer. So this is a list of titles. I think it covers, you know, the world range, and there is a lot of different. I mean, like, so it's difficult to, it's not an object you can define, you know, as a single, you know, defined, easy to frame object. Actually, you pass through different, let's say, like, areas, different zones. But for sure, there is this dystopic effect. And I guess this is, like, also, like, your one of your, let's say, like, maybe I would say signature on this record.
Yeah, and something that we've been developing since as well. I mean, this is the first time we worked. So it's worth saying that some of the environmental sounds you hear are from the Environments series. Are we sort of, you know, quoting or sampling?
Exciting.
Yeah, but also some of the environmental sounds are from data sets, audio data sets, from the gathered by scientists sort of in the wild. And I'd say that, you know, in addition to narrative that sort of works with actual scientific research and more speculative elements, there'd be possibly two other kind of signature moves. One is working with data sets as a kind of ready-made. We've done that quite a lot. And the other is working with clones. And this was the first time we worked with clones, but we've done it in several pieces since. And I think we'll continue to do it again, partly because the clone software that we use keeps doing new and weird things. And some things stabilize in it, and then certain new features get introduced. And so it does feel a little bit like an instrument that is evolving, that we can sort of push in slightly new directions.
I mean, the voice clone as a the cloned voice as an AI output, it's a very weird and specific kind of technical object. I think it's quite different from other outputs of AI, of generative AI. Maybe because our way of listening to voices is imbued with a different kind of set of psychological reactions, and also because when you hear your own voice reproduced as a clone, that you do have this sort of simultaneous sense of recognition and kind of alienation from it, that it feels like a part of you that has been separated and amputated, but still is kind of bears your trace.
Another thing is that you can draw out of a clone a performance that you sort of couldn't really get a human performer to do. And there's some examples of that on this. you know, the wild modulation of affect, as you were saying. But maybe a better example in some ways was would be the Kurt Schwitter's Ursonata that we, for Unsound, had performed by a clone. And it was staged in a cinema, and so we had a Sean stood on stage sort of silhouetted, so that he couldn't really be seen on stage, sort of in the dark, and a clone sort of introduced the piece, but it looked as if maybe Sean was doing it. And then the performance of Ursonata began that had been rendered by a clone. And, you know, our reaction when we first sort of heard the output was that, like, it was utterly unselfconscious. That it was sort of maybe a kind of, not, I hesitate to say perfection of, because it's not that we did it, but it's like the kind of, it felt somehow true to what Schwitter's had sort of intended. Mm. Like, that, like, there's no...
Well, we described the clone voice as being, you know, unself-conscious because there's no self and no consciousness.
It doesn't feel embarrassed.
Yeah, it's without shame, but also without a kind of pretension.
Right. No, exactly. And for that kind of piece, it felt like a really sort of brilliant rendering, sort of virtuosic in a way that would be very hard to achieve for a human.
It's sort of... You know, the clone performance has a Dadaistic character because it's sort of severs language from meaning in a certain way. It severs words from their appropriate affect. It severs speech from the speaking subject. You know, so these kinds of separations are interesting. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why the clones tell the stories in this record and why you might think of it as dystopic is that it's almost as if in the future, in some future moment, it's only the clones that remember, you know, that sort of remember a time before this sort of pervasive synthesis of nature or reproduction. So it's even the nostalgia for a kind of pre-synthetic world is the nostalgia of clones, as something that we were trying to suggest.
In the meantime, I mean, like what is said here about like the these clones as an instrument is also, for me, it echoes the essay you were talking about that you wrote. Around like a kind of maturity of AI as or a transformation of the aesthetic of AI, AI as a mode of production, and but also we talk about like AI as a kind of possible like computational kitsch. So maybe we can also try just to present a little bit the essay, and if we have, because we have like 10 minutes, 12 minutes to finish, so maybe we can just like also like have a glimpse of the you know.
Sure. So one of the next pieces that we did after Environments was originally conceived as a kind of songbook. We called it, what was it, an AI songbook?
Machine Listening.
Machine Listening songbook, yeah. We were sort of producing a collection of songs using generative AI, and specifically Suno, the software Suno, and another one called Udio, which listeners may be familiar with, I'm not sure. They're kind of like the most popular platforms, been a lot of investment from, you know,
venture capital
and so on. And we were pairing them with the cloning software that we were using. So it's not just a kind of a similar kind of logic. We were literally working with generative outputs in music and then trying to get the clones to sort of sing along, as it were. It's something you can do. You can set the clone to follow or try to reproduce a non-speech object. And when you do that, you get some quite strange outputs. Again, kind of uncanny, maybe dystopic. But
something like beatboxing, but the relationship to beatboxing is a bit like the relationship to speech that we've explored in this work, where it sort of sounds like beatboxing but without affect or intention.
And so that sort of began life as a songbook, as we were saying, but ended up as an album, actually.
So we've done two albums now. We should remember that.
We ended up calling it Songs About Fucking Suno, a reference to the Big Black album. And, taking a position, as it were, about generative music generation at a moment, sort of in 2024, when it felt like, for the first time, generative music was sort of entering the mainstream in a certain kind of way. And so the essay that you describe is actually a response to a previous essay, or sort of now a short book by the composer and performer Jennifer Walsh called
13 Ways of Looking at AI, Art and Music.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things she says is that for now, when she's writing in, I think, 22 or 2023, all AI art is about AI art.
Yeah, she says AI art is conceptual art and the concept is AI.
Right. And that in the future, that's no longer going to be the case. You know, that it will become banal to say that this was made with AI or a generative music generator. And I think that moment began to happen in 2024. There was a couple of tracks. There was a famous track called BBL Drizzy, which was part of the Kendrick Lamar Drake beef, and it was a big meme. It didn't like make it big compared with like Taylor Swift in terms of streams, but on TikTok, on YouTube, and on various other stream platforms, it was getting hundreds of thousands and the low millions, right? So this is a sort of a semi-mainstream object now, and it was entirely generated using automatic music generation. I think that kind of thing, there are many other examples actually, is increasingly going to happen. So we were quite interested in this kind of moment when music generation seems to be coming mainstream at the same time as the outputs that are being generated are, as you say, kind of kitsch. They don't sound like non-music, but they sound somehow very generic, but almost, in some of our experiments, like generic in a way that almost sounds experimental or kind of sort of deeply strange in a kind of interesting way.
Like normcore or corecore, like those sort of movements where the genericism is actually so over the top, it becomes uncomfortable and...
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a very similar aspect with the image generation, because because it's mainly trained on Shutterstock and all these kind of data banks. Actually, like, you have this kind of very, I mean, like a normcore, you know, imaginary, and it's very difficult, even if you try to, you know, get out from this. So you need to build your own software and to train it yourself, and if you want like crazy stuff. But with the, let's say, mainstream, you cannot really escape this kind of crazy, let's say, kitsch environment.
Yeah, so our record, Songs About Fucking Suno, I think it's sort of somewhere in between those two poles. Like, we've intervened in a way that sort of brings a certain kind of agency to make it really messed up and strange. But on the other hand, we leaned into the generic quality of the outputs at certain moments too. I think the first piece we're going to hear is kind of the most avant-garde piece on the record, because it's a choir of voice clones replicating John Coltrane's Giant Steps, and the source material is, you know, this kind of masterpiece of human musical production rendered as a kind of a clone libretto or virtual, you know, or kind of a cappella clone performance. But then some of the other tracks that we'll go into have a much more genre oriented quality.
And they're mostly about Suno in some way or other. Yeah. We've appropriated lyrics, for example, from Lawsuit Against Suno in one track, and you know.
Yes, and maybe just to conclude, because we are 5 minutes, so I'm gonna just launch at midnight exactly the playlist. So, but just for me, like a last echo is like, you know, we were talking about this series of records, environments, you know, as this kind of music you don't really listen to, but you hear, you know, in the background. And I think with AI music on Spotify, for example, it's also well known now, you know, they inject, you know, these AI generated songs on playlists, you know, like almost like, you know, without saying it, you know, like in this very like discreet mode. And then people, they don't really know, you know, what they are listening to. And so it's a bit, there is this kind of parallel in between these modes of, that's why also, like, you know, we talk a lot about music. I mean, as you know, this kind of ultimate kitsch music. And I think now we have the same, like, so there is a kind of circularity in this kind of, you know, kitsch is always, you know, finding new ways, new forms, and new...
It might just be worth, like, making the obvious point as well that capital is the driving force here. The reason that AI-generated music is on Spotify is because it's cheaper to license or free, you know. And, like, this is driving taste and aesthetic experience in a pretty direct way.
Yes. And maybe for finish, I'm just gonna switch back to French, so to just to give a few elements to the listeners. On vous remercie déjà d'avoir écouté cette émission. On est ravis d'avoir reçu les Machine Listening. Merci à vous. Thank you very much to come here and to take time. I know you have a very busy schedule. Demain, vous pouvez les retrouver donc à la Générale. Rue Gassendi, au 39 rue Gassendi, dans le 14e arrondissement de Paris, où il y aura donc une séance d'écoute et puis une discussion en live. Vous pourrez venir leur poser des questions. Tout ça à partir de 19h30. Ça commencera à 20h et ça sera diffusé sur Pinod, qui nous rediffuse aussi. Vous retrouverez bien sûr la playlist de l'émission sur le blog. Je l'ai dit tout à l'heure, mais je redis, je ne peux pas résister de redonner l'URL du blog. epsilonia-radio.blogspot.com. Vous pouvez retrouver donc toutes les archives, des liens, et notamment pas mal de liens vers la série Environnement, ce que je vous mettrai à disposition pour que vous puissiez un petit peu aller consulter tout ça, et puis bien sûr des liens vers le site de Machine Listening. Je crois que c'est machinelistening.exposed.exposed. Snowden est passé par là. Et puis, bien sûr, les liens vers le Bandcamp. Je pense que c'est un Bandcamp où on peut retrouver donc Songs About Fucking Suno qu'on va écouter dans les quelques minutes qui viennent. On vous remercie pour votre écoute et on vous souhaite une bonne nuit. Toute la nuit, donc les bandes sans fin, c'est les 11 volumes de la série Environments. 11 volumes of Environments Music all night long, until 10 o'clock in the morning. On va passer par toutes les phases des enregistrements avec des littoraux, des forêts, des jungles, des déserts. Des orages, il y a un superbe orage enregistré par Irv Table, donc le créateur de la série, depuis son appartement à New York. Voilà, donc tout ça, vous allez pouvoir l'écouter toute la nuit, avec bien sûr des petites irruptions de cet album Songs for Fucking Suno, c'est ça, qui viendra comme ça venir un peu parasiter l'écoute tout au long de la nuit. On vous remercie, on vous souhaite une bonne nuit. La semaine prochaine, c'est Samon Takahashi avec Epsilonia Mix, les Anarchives. Et puis voilà, tout l'été, de toute façon, on continuera de se retrouver. À bientôt.